You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
What is up, everybody? Welcome to Comic Book Club. I am Alex, and we are here with a special episode talking to Aaron Kuntz, the co-creator and co-showrunner and lead writer of Revival, which premieres on Sci-Fi Thursday, June 12th at 10 p.m. ETPT, and then a week later on Peacock. It is an adaptation of the awesome Image comic by Tim Seeley and Mike Norton. Aaron, welcome. Excited to chat.
Oh, so glad to be on here. Thank you so much.
Yeah. No problem. I was very excited to see that this finally came to fruition. We've talked to Tim and Mike throughout the years, and you've probably got the same reaction for them. But when we talked to them recently, they're like, I'll believe it when I actually see it on air at this point. But we're almost there. Like, it's actually coming up. To take a step back, though, you worked on Revealer with Tim Seeley, both the movie and the comic book. Are you two only allowed to work on projects together that start with R and E?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. And the amount of times that, especially when we were in post of Revealer and we were talking about Revival and we kept calling them the other thing, drove me absolutely nuts. And I'm pretty certain that there is a pitch document sent somewhere to someone that is talking about the show Revealer, because we were so distorted at times.
So more seriously, though, it's you, Tim, and Luke Boyce sort of feel like this triumvirate who has been behind this thing for a while and working together for a while. What is it that works about that partnership?
I mean, well, at first it started with like Luke and Tim have known each other for many, many years, right? And Luke got the rights to this comic with Tim, and it really was like pushing this boulder up the hill for so long and trying so hard. And we had such a wonderful time working on Revealer and, you know, just found this kind of kinship. It was like, look, these are like my people and we really get along. And Luke was the one who's like, hey, man, I've got this project. Like, I want you to kind of look into this. And I was like, oh, Revival. Like, yeah, I know what that is. I hadn't read the comic. I had read Hack Slash. I was one of those. And but I obviously knew Tim Seeley and I had heard of it. And I was like, yeah, let me check it out. And I read that first issue and I was like, guys, this is a pilot. Like, this is a pilot. Like, this is so interesting. They've created such interesting characters. And, you know, and I think, like, Luke and I always joke about how we just feel like we're brothers. I mean, in so many ways, like, our lives parallel each other. And then as I got to know Tim, it became the same thing. Like, we have so many similar backgrounds of, like, growing up in religious homes and we're now atheists and, like, all this weird stuff. And, like, we're all Midwesterners. I'm from Indianapolis. They're from Illinois and Chicago, obviously. And, like, it just – and I spent a lot of time in Chicago as well. There was, like, a kinship. There was something there. And then our sense of humor. Like, our sense of humor is all the same. We tell a lot of like weird bad dad jokes, but then also like have like a very dark gallows humor and everything. So it just kind of created this trio, if you will. And, you know, when Tim was like, listen, like take it and run with it, guys, like do your thing, you know, and then just check in with me. And that's what we really started doing. And it became something really, really special. And I'm so glad that, you know, he's proud of it. I know he's seen the first few episodes and like, it makes me so happy that him and Mike are digging it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, obviously part of the reason this is coming to TV clearly is the chemistry between you three guys among, you know, the cast and everybody else that is involved. But this, like we've been kind of intimating, has had a very long circuitous path to screen. There's been multiple tries at a TV show. There's been tries at a movie. I think you guys were initially talking about it in a movie, if I remember correctly. So why did it work this time? Like, why is this the time that finally brought Revival to screen?
I mean, you know, Luke Luke had it. Like, they, I read, like, there was a movie script that I had read, and that's really what he pitched me for. Because, so my background, I run a company called Paper Street Pictures. We make a lot of genre films, a lot of horror films. I've produced about 25 features at this point. And this is where they're like, hey, Aaron's the guy who can get stuff done. I actually have the reputation of getting the things like, okay, here's a $10 million idea, and we got $500,000, you know, and like, how do we get those things made? And that's kind of where my specialty has been as a company. And then at the same time, coming off of, I helped them with Revealer, and I sold that film to Shudder and everything that was there. And Tim was so jaded, and he still is, even after this, I'm sure he's still wonderfully jaded.
I mean, that's Tim. That's how Tim is.
So. Totally. And I love it. I love it. And, you know, but within that, he's, you know, it was just like, yeah, look, yeah, give it a shot. Like, whatever you think you can do, you know, what's there. And I was like, okay, like I think I can get something made. And he was so blown away that Revealer got made. He's like, I can't believe I wrote something and it actually became like a movie that people can watch. Like, this has never happened. You know, everybody tells me it's going to happen. And I was instrumental in part of that process, you know? And so I think it was, they really thought that I could come together, and I had some relationships that I knew I could leverage. And being the producer that I've been and knowing as many buyers and distributors and companies, I had some relationships that I knew I could lean on and say, listen, like, I can come in from a executive producer type role here, because initially what this was all going to be for me, and I can make sure this thing gets done. And we were talking about bringing in experienced showrunners and that whole thing. But then the more I got into it, the more I was like, oh my God, the story. Like, you know, I started out as a writer. So like, this is my thing. And then Luke was so passionate about it too. I was like, dude, let's just do this together. You know, that might limit where we can go and who's going to give us that shot. That's first time showrunners. But I was like, me and you have something here. Like, this is a really cool comic. I know these people. They don't know what they're doing. So like, let's just go make our own thing. And I was very fortunate to the executive at NBC that actually was pivotal in getting this greenlit, I've known for 10 years. And I made a feature film with him. It was a huge failure. We actually joke that our film together is what took down the Chiller Network, which used to be like a thing. Yeah. Even though I really think it was Tom Cruise's The Mummy, but we're not going to go there. but those were the things that happened, and we just had maintained a good relationship. And he remembered, you know, that I deliver things on time, on budget. We're good at working within restrictions, and there's not a lot of money on sci-fi shows. And they know that the movies that I make look a lot bigger than the budget we have. And I think that got us in the room and have an interesting conversation. We had an interesting take on how we wanted to do this as a series, and was very fortunate that I was able to sell the show.
Well, let's talk about that take then. So the series is so many different things, the comic book series. Tim describes it as a farm noir. I think that's like on the first page, but that only kind of touches on it a little bit. Certainly there's elements of that, but there's supernatural. There's kind of skitters past superhero stuff a little bit, mystery, rom-com, so many things. So when it comes time to adapt it for a TV show, that's, as I'm sure you're aware, a different medium. You got to adapt it in different ways. You got to pare things down. How did you focus in on the tone of the TV show, and how would you describe that?
Yeah, I mean, so like, as I was reading the comics and going through those 47 issues, it goes in some wild directions, as you just alluded to. I mean, there's Amish ninjas in this stuff. You know what I mean? Like, I'm like, whoa, okay, like Dana going to New York and where this goes. Like, there's some pretty crazy stuff. And but it had a core story that I was like, this is Mayor of Easttown. Like, if you play this up the right way, there is a murder mystery where the person is now alive trying to solve their own murder. And I'm like, I've never seen that before. And if I play with that hook, I thought I could sell the show off that hook, right? Not as it's a zombie show, but not a zombie show and all these things, whatever, but as a murder mystery where they're still alive, because I knew murder mysteries sell. People like what that is. And I knew that there was an opportunity to focus on that while still allowing us to have those like Fargo-esque characters that Tim and Mike had created and get into that quirkiness and that weirdness, you know, from Tim's background, you know, being from Wausau, as you know. And so when we were able to do this and say like, look, you know, and I think the eventual pitch became, bear with me, I think it was like, it's Fargo characters meets the intrigue of Mayor of Easttown with like the twist of an Agatha Christie, you know, in a supernatural, you know, rapper, you know, and all this, and you know how you have to pitch and how bullshit that is. But we were able to get into that, and honestly, that is still what the show is. I mean, it is those things. And I love playing with tone. It's very much just in my wheelhouse just as a creative as well. And I was like, I feel like I can write these characters. Like I can see what we always talked about was between the panels, the things that you're like, oh, you're hinting at something. And then we would talk to Tim and Mike and like, oh yeah, we had this idea to go this whole direction. Mm-hmm. And then we couldn't. And this became really popular. So we had to pump this out really fast. And, you know, so we're doing this instead. And I'm like, huh, okay, well, what if we did go that direction? And what if we did play with some of that stuff? And being able to pick their brains at the same time, while also having all this amazing material, just became this like really interesting sweet spot. This amalgamation of how that came together, I think, was really, really special. But I mean, it became though the murder mystery, the Cypress family, focus on the sisters, focus on the Cypress family. And if we make that a season one, then we have so much more that we can build onto. What costs Revival Day? What are the things beyond that? What are all the crazy things people will do as a result of Revivers being there? And that, which we still have throughout the season, but it's going to get there in ways that fans of the comic might not expect. And that's very deliberate. It was like, where are they going to think, okay, oh, clearly this is this character. This is what this is going to be. And then we push you along this path and you kind of feel like that's what's going to happen. And then it's like, nope, it was this character and we pull the rug. And I think that was a fun thing to play with. Like, what are the audience expectations? What are the comic fans' expectations? And then, but while also still delivering on something that's, you know, making sure we're respecting how amazing the source material is at the same time. So that was just a fun balance. And Tim, you know, who's just the funniest dude, would all, him and Mike all the time would like come in, they were in the writer's room and stuff. And he's like, shit, I should have thought of that, you know, things like that, that would come in. So it was really fun.
Yeah. Well, if you don't mind, I want to get even a little wonkier about this process. So you're talking about the pitch to Sci-Fi. At that point, how much did you have broken down? Was it sort of like the broad strokes of here's how that worked in a TV show? Had you broken the whole season? At what point were you at?
Well, so there's a lot of layers to how that all happened. So Luke had been with this material for so long. I mean, he had a limited series deck that he had done. He had a little story Bible that he had. So there's a lot of material that was there. And then him and I got together and we're like, hey, let's figure out where this can really go. And then we also brought in Michael Morici, who, you know, as well, who wrote on Revealers, also a wonderful comic creator. And we actually went to the old Wachowski offices where they made The Matrix out in Chicago and sat in those offices. We're like, okay, what does this mean? Where could we go?
Soaking in the creativity from the walls, letting them come to you.
Dude, literally, the walls had Matrix ones and zeros and stuff really? On the table and everything. Oh, that's so cool. Yeah, it was so cool. And I'm like, oh my God, this is so rad. So it was really fun. And we kind of took all that in. But then we didn't want to restrict ourselves. So it was like, I'm just a big proponent of TV, and you'll hear this as a cliche, but TV is character. Like when I grew up watching, you know, I'm watching Lost and, you know, I see that in the background. I love Lost. I almost got Not Penny's Boat tattooed on my hands. Oh, man. And I think about, you know, but it wasn't because I was like, what crazy shit is going to happen. Don't get me wrong. That happened as well. But I wanted to know, like, was Sawyer's long con going to pay off? Mm-hmm. I wanted to know if like what Desmond's purpose was and where he fit in to this. I wanted to feel Jack and like all of those characters are what I tuned in for. I cared about that emotion and what was there. And I was so drawn into that. And I think where you lose yourself in TV is when you get too focused in the high concept, big idea, and you don't pare it down to focus on those characters. And I'd always call them our Linklater moments, you know, like just like at these two great people talking, like in the pilot, one of my favorite scenes is Em and Dana talking in a car. Mm-hmm. Because we are alluding to so many things that are going to happen in the season. So many things behind the surface or even in that conversation, but it's just two great actors. I love them so much and became such good friends with both as a result. And just seeing them like act the hell out of this moment and take these words that I wrote that I thought were silly and now have become really special because of these performances. And you're like, man, that's the show. Like, that's what the show's about. It's about Dana and him, you know? And once you do that, then you can really focus. And then you could throw some weird shit in and all this stuff could happen. But you have your path. You see your walkway. And you just kind of, ooh, it'd be fun to go for it. No, stay here. and then like hint at these things, and how can now the craziness and the wonderful absurdity that can come into revival, how can that come into the path and organically play in a story that is more streamlined? And that was the challenge.
By the way, I just want to say you're speaking my language. I don't know if you can see, but I have a Lost box set right behind me over here. So big fan as well.
I own the same box set. Yes.
Yep. There you go. Yep. I did want to ask you about the Dana and M relationship, because that is so important to get right. That's so central to the story of not just the show, but the comic book as well. What was the process like when you were casting, getting Melanie Scrofano and Romy Weltman, and then making sure that they had the right relationship on screen?
Yeah. I mean, it was tough. I mean, at first, well, it was easy and then it was tough, because it was a little bit of both. Like we had these like huge ideas of what it could be. And then we had some Canadian needs that we needed to kind of hit some money, because getting shows made, you got to find ways to come up with these other soft funds and stuff. So we needed the Canadian aspect. So we started there at first, and then had some other US actors that we really loved and we were playing in. And then we had this list that came through, and I saw Melanie Scrofano on the list. I mean, it all started with Dana. It all started with Dana, because that was the domino that had to fall. We would match to Dana. We wanted to create a little bit more of an age gap for some story elements that we were changing. And then we wanted to make sure that they felt real as sisters. And then obviously Wayne, and then who could be, you know, the potential love interest in Ibrahim, all those things. But again, the domino started with Dana. And we got this list, and I was like, oh, Melanie Scrofano. Like, oh yeah. I went on ERP. I saw that. She's really funny. Like that's, she's got some cool stuff. I remember in Letterkenny, you know, and she was really ridiculous with Letterkenny. It's so crude and crass. I'm like, she's fine girl. Like, I wonder, you know, where's the drama, you know, the melodrama. And then I started watching more of her stuff, and I was like, whoa. Like, and I remember Luke and I were talking, and it's like, put some freckles on her, and that's Dana, you know. Yeah. like she, and not just that, but like her literal personality as a human is Dana, you know. And so then, and I think that's always a fun thing to do when you're casting, is like, look, you can go against type and stuff and different things, but sometimes it's like good to say, does this person embody what that is? And like David James Elliott from JAG is kind of Wayne, but like in real life, you know. And Romy's a little different as far as Martha and M, but I think there was something really special about leaning into that. And it started with Dana, and she just completely blew us away and immediately became the top of the list. There were relationships that were there. We went all in. And I mean, I look, people will say this, you'll get people who'll come on and they'll say, oh, my actors and all this, sometimes performative, sometimes they have to say certain things. I'm telling you, my actors are so amazing. They are so good. And I think when people see what, as far as where they all go, and then the sister relationship, and like what happens with Dan and M and Romy and Mel, I think, I mean, we cry. I mean, literally Luke and I, at one point, I remember we're looking at each other crying. We're like, what is happening? Like, because of the emotion that was going on. Then this other time we're blowing takes, like we're laughing so loud. Right? Like that's the dichotomy of what we created. And I'm really proud that we were able to balance that tone. But again, that started in a comic as well.
Yeah. I want to ask you a couple of specifics about the show again, without too much getting into spoilers or anything. Maybe this is a spoiler. It certainly wasn't in the first four episodes that I saw, but when does this take place? And I only ask because everybody is using flip phones.
Yeah. So it's interesting. Originally, we leaned into this where it was very overtly 2008. And then sci-fi was like, no, it needs to be nebulous and all this. So I guess technically, we're not saying what it is, but it's 2008.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. Why? I mean, the book came out in 2012. So why 2008 specifically?
There's a combination of things. One, I just cringed at the idea of someone wanting to do a TikTok on Revivers. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, do I have to answer this question? Or like, is someone going to fly a drone over Wausau to see what's like? I just started thinking of all these like rash, like silly things that could happen that were there. And then also, I think there's a dynamic without social media, at least at the peak, you know, I mean, I guess we were on MySpace or whatever, Friendster or whatever it was at the time, but like, it wasn't hitting to where it is now. I thought it was really intriguing. But then also for Luke and I, we, you know, in our ages, it allowed us a very specific era of like flashback in the show where like we were certain ages of characters. So we could really think about like, what did we listen to? What were we into? All this in a very specific time frame. So it kind of, it gave us like a little sweet spot. And, you know, we played with a number of years, but 2008 felt like the right place. Again, a lot of it I'll just admit is because I didn't want to deal with the social media aspect of it. And I just thought, because even though there's some of that does play with like Rhodey in the comic, you know, and there's some things that happens there that I didn't want to go with. And I wanted to go a different direction. And Rhodey's character is pretty different in our show. But yeah, that was a big driver for me. I'm like, I don't want someone to have a Reviver YouTube channel, at least not right now. You know, it just doesn't feel right just yet. Yeah.
It's interesting you're saying this in terms of the time period, not to spend too much time on this, but at the same time, a lot of the stuff that you're dealing with in terms of how people deal with the Revivers, these people who have come back from the dead in the show, feels incredibly timely and of the moment in 2025 in a very laudable way. So how do you strike that balance, making it 2008/timeless, but also reflecting the world outside of our window?
I mean, history repeats itself, right? Sure. You know, like where there is something that's there. I mean, I will say there was also the other aspect of 2008 was that was also the big market crash, where I think there were a lot of fears going on of like how we're going to make it and like stoking that fear and what people were losing their homes. And we literally talk about it in a later episode. Like there's lines talking about that. And so I think that just created a little bit of an undercurrent. Like we don't hit the market crash like that. They're not worried about that, you know, in our show. They have bigger fish to fry. But I think there was something about that that was important. And then, look, I felt it when I read the comic. You know, I was like, oh my God, like this feels like COVID. This feels like this. This feels like immigration. This feels like gay rights. This feels like all these things that I thought were so relevant and are so unbelievable. I've just become more relevant. I mean, the amount of times that Luke and I will share a story and we'll be like, oh my God, this is really happening. Look at this. This is exactly what we wrote and it's happening. And because the writing's on the wall and, you know, and what it feels like for people to not feel safe in their own town. And then also what is perpetuating the hate, what is creating this? And, you know, we did the biggest character that changes from the comic to here, which might be frustrating for people here, is in Blaine's character. Even though there's a lot of good weirdness, he still does exorcisms and is a, you know, a snow pub. He works on he's a tow truck delivery guy and works on snow plows, and he may or may not like Limp Bizkit anymore, but like he is, you know, he is a weird character. But I wanted someone to represent more of that religious fervor of what was going on, and also someone that could help understand that, you know, hate creates more hate, and like how are we creating these people that are going to start to hate others, and what does that mean? And without being preachy about it, you know, and just like this is happening all around us. So we lean into it. I have no qualms with leaning into it. I was excited to lean into it without, though, again, being preachy. I think that was just the thing. I don't want it to feel like we're trying to hammer a point as much as ask a question. Yeah. And say, how does that make you feel? You know, and it should make you feel something, and it makes me feel something every day when I watch the news. And I think as people are watching the show, especially as the stakes continue to get raised, you know, that you'll see that happen as well.
I have been forbidden to talk about some specific spoilers, so I'm not going to bring them up. But I was curious to get your take as a showrunner. What constitutes a spoiler for a TV series when the source material has been out there for well over a decade?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think there's a couple that we want to have fun with in the pilot for people that haven't read the comic, that I think, because what I want someone to experience is what I experienced. And this really is just selfishly. I read the comic, I didn't know where it was going, and I get to that barn and Arlene, and then I'm like, what? You know, that happened to me. And I'm hoping that there'll be some illusions, people might guess some stuff, that's fine. But I think I want them to be able to have that moment. So this was something I fought for to try to have. I was like, let's just try to hold this, you know? And then beyond that, you know, I think it's, what I think is really fun is for fans of the comic that watch the first episode or be like, oh my God, this is really close to what's going on. And we're going to pull you along into something that feels like, oh, it's going this direction. And then as soon as we're about to zig where you think we're going to zag. And it's going to be like, whoa, wait, what? Like that was a fun thing to play with. And so even the ones who are like, you know, I hope they're like their partner, like, oh, watch what's going to happen here. They'll be right a number of times. Don't get me wrong. But there's also a number of times they're going to be like, oh, whoa, did not see that coming. And was a lot of fun. So, you know, I mean, I wanted to have a sense of excitement and that twisting nature of it that can happen even for the comic lover of it, the one who so understands and cherishes the source material like we do. So, and guess what it was? Luke and I were like making it for ourselves, who love the comic. We're reading it. We know what it is. We know what's expecting. And how can we twist that, you know, and how can we like, what would I have enjoyed as watching it? And it's been fun to see Tim and Mike, you know, go through like, what? You know, and love it and just be like, why didn't we do that? Like, oh my God, that's so fun. So.
Yeah. We actually had a question on our Discord when somebody heard about the show where they were wondering like, okay, what do I need to reread before the season? I know, like you're saying, it goes far afield. And as I've seen, same sort of thing. I was like, I don't remember that happening in the comic book. But if you did have a guide for any comic book fans who want to check it out again, is there like first volume for first season? Not exactly. What's your recommendation there?
Man, how do I say this without giving anything away? There are things that happen in the last issue of the comic that happened in season one.
Ooh, all right.
So it is, but it's not complete. Like we have, you know, Luke and I in particular have three seasons that we really are excited about that'll continue to pull from the comics while also building upon ideas that were there, like ideas that Tim and Mike had that they wanted to go into or we would call them side quests, you know, and what those could be. And so those are still there. Those still exist in these future seasons of it. But it's, I mean, like if you really would do it, you'd read the compendium, which is amazing. The Image Comics mm-hmm. has put out. And we might have something special coming with Image that I can tease, but I can't say, which would be really, really fun. And we might, you know, if people go to some type of place on the West Coast in July dealing with comics, maybe we'll be there with some stuff. So I don't know what that means.
Some sort of comic convention, some comic con, if you will.
That's an interesting term.
Just throwing that out there.
Phrase. Yeah. But you know, we might be there, out there just, you know, going to the beach and stuff and maybe other things. So, but there's stuff that's there. And I would recommend, you know, if you're going to check it out, I mean, I would read the whole thing again because I did it again after we finished making, you know, we got into post just to be like, is there anything I'm missing or what's there? And I worked with one of my people at Paper Street Pictures, my main company, where we created a document and it's like 15 pages of like what we call opportunities. That's like, oh, we teased this, but we could have gone so much further with what this is. And like, and when people watch the whole season, it needs to feel like I'm a big proponent, especially because look, we're on sci-fi. I know how it works, right? Like we don't have any guarantees. This is why I'm so grateful for people like you that are talking about our show, because that's what gives us a chance to continue to make future seasons. But when Luke and I talked about it, I was like, this needs to be able to stand on its own either way. It needs to feel like it needs to stand on its own. And while still pushing like really, really fun stuff that can go, and teasers and cliffhangers that can happen. But like, I don't want to be Carnival, which I loved, you know, and it ends and I'm like, I can't even rewatch it now with my girlfriend. Oh, I love to show that show because it ends and then we never get to see where it's going. So it had to feel like it has something to it. So we do have that, you know, here, which might surprise people with 47 issues of a comic, but it's, you'll see, you know what I mean? Like you'll see and how that goes. I will also say lastly, for fans of the comic, and you're watching these first few episodes and you're like, where the hell is this thing that might be in the woods that is very early on? And I just want to make sure everyone knows, don't worry, it's here. I promise you. And it's a Seinfeld quote and it's fantastic. That's great. It's a practical puppet, full nine yards, super cool. So love it. And you just gotta, we're trickling it along a little bit here. So
awesome. Thank you for answering my last question before I asked it. Aaron, congratulations on the show. Very excited to check out the rest of it and very nervous about the end of the season, but appreciate the nerves.
It's good. It'll be, I think fans of the comic are going to be very happy. Yeah.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.